This is the Awful Announcing Podcast.
Three-pointer.
Oh, Huggins! Double honor!
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, wow! In your life have you seen anything like that?
Oh!
LeBron James with no regard for human life!
Welcome to the AA Podcast.
Maddie. What are you still doing here?
Here's Matt Yoder.
We welcome back to the Awful Announcing Podcast on episode 99. One of our favorite guests, our most frequent guest, the New York Times number one bestseller, the authority on all things Bristol, Connecticut, the author of Those Guys Have All the Fun, James Andrew Miller. Jim, thanks for being with us once again.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with, of course, the ESPN story of the year. And that is the three-week suspension of Bill Simmons. He seems to be handling it well on his Instagram page, golfing and getting the manicures and pedicures and whatnot. But let's focus first on the length of the suspension. Why 3 weeks? Why such a severe punishment for Simmons?
Well, so it's 2 weeks unpaid and 1 week paid. You know, it's an interesting thing with these suspensions at ESPN. It's somewhat emblematic or somewhat reflective of what goes on at the NFL, right? You get these suspensions for like 2 weeks, 3 weeks, whatever. So started with the whole Ray Rice thing with, you know, two games. And you think, well, why is it that length? It's a very hard thing to talk about in terms of ESPN history because obviously, you saw what happened with Stephen A. Smith and his suspension. Tony Kornheiser had his. There's been many suspensions through the years. People, the first reaction to Bill Simmons' suspension for 3 weeks was it was incredibly long. It is a very long suspension in terms of.
And Jim, if I can just interrupt, I don't know if the details that you just talked about with the paid versus the unpaid has been out there in the public arena yet.
I'm not sure. It was 2 weeks unpaid and 1 week paid.
That's an interesting detail.
You know, but 3 weeks is, that's a pretty big matzo ball. And I think that Bristol wanted to send a signal that they were, you know, that this was not just your normal type of suspension. And just to give people context and reminder, Tony Kornheiser got 2 weeks for his comments about Hedda Storm's wardrobe. So this was quite serious.
You tweeted when Simmons was suspended about a civil war behind the scenes. How has that evolved from the people that you've talked to at ESPN? And why is there such polarization about this suspension?
Well, you have to go back a couple of years because Bill Simmons started to create a huge following at ESPN, and when he did that and basically overtook Rick Riley, who, you know, at that point in time was the dot-com presence and, you know, had a following, when he started to amass that kind of power, there were two different schools of thought inside Bristol. One was, wow, we've really been able to catch on to somebody who's going to be important to us. And the second is, uh-oh, here comes an oversized personality who's going to think that they have control over us. You know, the power base in Bristol is, they take their authority and they take their job seriously. They don't like people who think that they're bigger than the four letters. The brand is always the most important thing in their mind. So when you get somebody who has, you know, a following and a lot of attention, a lot of power behind their own name, that creates inner turmoil. And you clearly saw it with the NBA Countdown show last year. And so all of this that's happening now is just an extension of that.
Jim, is it your understanding that Simmons was suspended more for calling Roger Goodell a liar, more for his public challenge to his bosses, or a combination of both?
I think the public challenge to the bosses got him an extra 2 weeks.
Wow.
I mean, look, you can't say that he was suspended because he was being really tough on the NFL, or even to go so far as to say that Goodell was a liar, because anybody looking at you know, the great work Don Van Atta did, what Keith Olbermann was doing on his show. I don't think that anybody thinks that ESPN was going soft on the league. In fact, I think that people at the league have been quite upset at ESPN in particular. I mean, all other sports divisions have been covering the Ray Rice issue and things that have flown from that. But I think that there is a perception that ESPN was particularly tough. So you can't say that ESPN suspended Bill for saying negative things about the NFL, but I think the taunting, as some people in Bristol refer to it as, you know, I dare you, definitely got him a couple weeks. So I break it down as 1 week calling the commissioner a liar and 2 for taunting.
And that's quite the reversal of fortune that we've seen with ESPN's relationship with the NFL in the past. You look at playmakers, what happened with League of Denial, so it's a bit ironic we find ourselves in this current context. If you look at Bill Simmons and his relationship with John Skipper, has Simmons lost the ESPN president? Is this a relationship, this 3-week suspension, that is now irrevocably damaged by these events? Or do you think that there's some way, when Bill Simmons returns after the suspension, that some fences can be mended?
Part of it is John Skipper's DNA is such, I mean, he is the least Nixonian person. There are many people who have kind of gone out of the ESPN orbit, who have been brought in. He believes in mending fences. In fact, look, Keith Olbermann returned to ESPN on Skipper's watch. Skipper doesn't hold grudges. He really doesn't believe in that kind of psychology. So I think that there's a great opportunity for Bill Simmons and John Skipper to continue. That's not the problem. The problem is the layers underneath Skipper, where I do think that there is some tension that exists between Simmons and, you know, others at the network. And again, it comes down to this issue of power and, you know, people who think that Simmons is trying to be more important than the network.
It's certainly been a rough year for him at ESPN, and maybe the most tumultuous if you look not just at this suspension, but as you mentioned, what happened with NBA Countdown and how that kind of fizzled, and the image that is etched into my memory is Simmons kind of pouting about his lack of airtime and Sage Steele just kind of shaking her head at him. I don't know if she meant that to be caught on air or not, but it really said a lot about the dynamics there. So given this year that Simmons has had at Bristol, do you see any scenario, his contract is up next year, do you see any scenario where he leaves the network to either go to a competitor or maybe launch his own independent portal?
Well, let's go backwards for a second, because I just, in the interest of, like, perspective, I think that, you know, the year has been mixed, because while the NBA Countdown show, I think, is clearly an underachiever, and you had the suspension, I think Grantland probably had, you know, continued to have it, to take it to another level. The 30 for 30 documentary series that Bill Simmons is involved in was very good, had a great year, and development-wise and production-wise. So I think, you know, you got to put it in the right context. I don't think it was a total loss at all for Simmons. But, you know, having said that, look, you look the other day at the huge deal that ESPN and the NBA did. I mean, this is serious, serious money. It's a long-term deal. And you think, okay, great, they can do this deal, but they can't do a show. I'm sure that Sage didn't think that she was going to be on camera. But at the same time, I think that it's incumbent upon Bristol to turn out a better NBA show than they did last year. That show didn't make any sense on numerous levels.
Mm. Well, it is interesting, too, because now Bill Simmons is being given his own NBA show with the Grantland basketball show. And it just so happens, and I don't know if you heard this conspiracy theory, but it was amongst our Twitter followers that, you know, maybe the suspension and the timing of it was done to give a nice little ratings boost to that show when Bill Simmons makes his triumphant return. But it's just so interesting to see the evolution here. And I wonder if Simmons is the type of guy to say, you know, I finally had enough with all of these levels of management, finally had enough of butting my head up against these corporate suits. And I don't know if I see him necessarily making a jump to, let's say, Fox or Turner. But, Jim, I could see Simmons, given his personality, given his history, saying, you know what, I'm done with this. I'm off to do my own thing.
Well, look, the nature of technology, right, in the media landscape today is such that you don't need to have a big place behind you, right? He could do, he could create his own ecosystem that has, you know, a web presence, podcast, print, everything he would want to do, and he doesn't even have to be tied to, you know, a network. That's totally true. He could also quite easily go and create his own version of Grantland. My understanding, by the way, is Bill Simmons leaves ESPN, Grantland stays at ESPN, mm-hmm. but the whole thing is Grantland is basically, you got to think about something. Grantland is just a word. I mean, at the end of the day, the people who work for Grantland and the relationships they have and the reason why people write for them and people work for them or whatever is probably inextricably linked with Bill and his team. And so the bigger question isn't whether the word Grantland would stay with ESPN. The bigger question is, could Simmons, if he left, basically take the Grantland staff with him and go someplace else and just call it someplace else? And, you know, if I was in Vegas, I would be betting that he would be able to do that if he decided to leave, because I think a lot of people who work with him and for him there, you know, would basically walk through fire for him. So, you know, it might be a fair victory for Bristol in the sense that, yes, get to keep Bristol, Grantland, but, you know, how many people would actually stay?
So gut feeling right now, here we are October 9th. Do you think Bill Simmons re-signs with ESPN next year, or do you see him going somewhere else, and if so, where?
I think the most important thing that's actually happened, I apologize in advance that this is too inside baseball, but to answer that question, I'm going to look back on an announcement of the past 30 days, which is that Bob Iger has extended his contract with Disney, because Bob Iger staying at Disney means that, look, there's another contract that's up next year, and not a lot of people talk about it, but John Skipper's up next year, I believe.
Uh-huh.
And so when you start to think about Bob Iger staying, then I think that enhances the possibility that John Skipper stays. And I do think that Skipper and Simmons are, you know, should probably be able to work this out, particularly now that the NBA countdown show is, you know, off the table, because that was just a malignancy that was just not going to, you know, that just was too big a problem for both of them.
Wow. That'll be very interesting to see how it plays out. You mentioned one thing in there, Jim, about John Skipper mending fences, bringing Keith Olbermann back. And since we've last had you on, you know, we've seen Olbermann, Michelle Beadle, Jason Whitlock all return to ESPN, all have a big presence on the network. Whitlock's site is still under construction, but Olbermann has been there, has been a model citizen, it seems like, at least from the outside looking in, for the year that he spent in New York working for ESPN. Beadle's back at Sports Nation. Does this represent a change in course for ESPN, and is it a response to the launch of Fox Sports 1 and this increased competition that they now feel comfortable bringing back these big-name personalities who maybe have trouble standing behind the four-letter ESPN brand and serving all that is encompassed within those four letters?
Well, you know, like just a perspective, before a couple years ago, the idea that somebody could return to ESPN was very, very difficult. I mean, Susie Culver did it. She was at ESPN, then she went to Fox, and she came back to ESPN. I'm sure there's probably one or two other examples that I can think of, but let's put it this way. Statistically speaking, they were outliers. So now you have under Skipper this idea, you know, Beadle was at NBC, she came back, as you mentioned, Keith, Jason, other. That's a big, big change culturally. How much of a reaction it is to Fox, I'm not sure, because at the end of the day, I believe that John Skipper is in no way worried about Fox on any level. On any level. I just don't think, you know, when Fox started up, there was lots of articles and stories and, you know, analysis about, oh my gosh, the, you know, the competition and is this, you know, what's going to happen with her ESPN and whatever. He just doesn't, I just don't think he thinks of it like that.
Wow. Most of the hype, by the way, coming from Fox themselves on that challenge to ESPN right out of the gate for Fox Sports 1.
Right, but to your point, though, do you think this is a response to Fox? I think little of what happens in Burbank and Bristol regarding ESPN and how ESPN spends its money and who they decide to get in business with has anything to do with Fox. I mean, there have been some cases, talent-wise, I think that ESPN has probably overpaid, or at least they paid a little bit more, maybe because they didn't want somebody going over there. There's probably been, you know, at least a couple visible cases like that. But at the end of the day, I still think that they're really not particularly influenced by that at all.
How surprised are you that Olbermann's return to ESPN has gone so smoothly, given the history there?
Well, you know, up on Keith is you know, a favorite indoor sport amongst many, and so if you're gonna beat up on him, you also got to give him credit. Here's the amazing thing, which is not only has he been a practicing adult and been behaving, but he behaved in the face of a lot of crap. I mean, that show when it was on at night was hardly appointment viewing in the sense that you could never figure out when it was going to go on. And there were a lot of times when he got bumped and then bumped and bumped. He kept quiet. His executive producer, for lack of a better word, the guy who was in charge of it, Jamie Horowitz, wound up going through a difficult transition at ESPN when he wanted to go to NBC. And, you know, the old Keith, I think, would have said, hey, wait a second, you know, cut it out. This is all about me. And Keith Olbermann was incredibly... You know, I mean, he was just a great team player in the sense that there was some transition going on with Horowitz. And, you know, he didn't talk publicly about it. He didn't complain about it. He just figured it will sort itself out when it does. So, you know, I have to say, I sometimes think that Keith doesn't get enough credit when he's behaving as much as he gets blamed when he's not behaving. So I think his return to ESPN has been a really interesting watch, because he's clearly, you know, you can't accuse him of any of the things that he's been accused of in the past.
Olbermann has behaved well. We've seen some ESPN personalities behave badly, Stephen A. Smith amongst them in recent months. When you lump Stephen A. Smith, Bill Simmons, Max Kellerman, Dan Le Batard, all of these personalities being suspended in the summer and the early fall, how has this rash of suspensions changed the mindset in Bristol? When we see not just the severity of the Bill Simmons suspension, Stephen A. Smith, his comments on domestic violence, do you sense any landscape-altering changes that all of these suspensions have produced?
Well, you know, again, not to be boring about the historical perspective, but remember, like, they got over like 1,000 people who were on air. And, you know, we're talking about sports, and we're talking about healthy doses of ego and paranoia and oversized personalities. So the idea that people say silly things or do stupid things is not new to ESPN. In fact, there was a period, you know, for a couple of years there where things were so calm, I was, like, scratching my head, like, you know, what are they putting in those Arnold Palmers in the cafeteria? Because it just seems like we've gotten an unusual amount of time without, you know, somebody doing something silly. But, you know, look, these things are going to happen. And, you know, particularly in this universe where if you say something like Stephen A. did, you know, in terms of the quote-unquote provoking aspect of the Ray Rice thing, it gets blown up right away. It goes on Twitter. It goes, you know, social media. It's not like you can hide anything. Nothing is hidden anymore. So as a result, you got all these people out there. You know, a lot of it is live television. A lot of it is they're trying to, you know, get repeated, and they're trying to make their mark, and their brand is that they're ostentatious and provocative. So, you know, sometimes things are going to be said, but by and large, you know, you don't have the kind of big, huge cultural things that you had, like with, you know, back in the days of, you know, of ESPN. So they're probably happier now than they were back then.
Interesting. Let's move into the new NBA television deal. $24 billion over 9 years with ESPN and Turner. ESPN now paying over $1 billion a year for the league. Is this why we didn't see them spend on the World Cup? And is ESPN now in the position where they have to be selective, given the explosion in rights fees, with what exactly they buy and put on the network?
Well, the World Cup was, correct me if I'm wrong, but that was a blind deal. I think that they would have spent whatever they needed to spend to get that. I think that was probably, you know, if you look at the past decade of ESPN and rights deals and whatever, that was one of the more heartbreaking ones because they went down to South Africa. They, in their minds, elevated the World Cup to a whole different level. And then, you know, they had to say goodbye to it after, you know, after this recent round. They had to say goodbye. And that was really hard for them. So I think they would have spent the money had they had the opportunity. I'm not so sure, given the enormity of, I mean, they don't have money for everything, but I think that they still have the money that they need to go after the things that they do. So we'll see now. I mean, there's a Big Ten deal coming up in the next couple of years. Fox, obviously, is in business with the Big Ten. A lot of the Fox people went to Big Ten schools, so they have a huge appetite and a huge devotion to Big Ten. So we'll see what ESPN is able to do with that and how much money they're gonna spend on that. But this NBA deal for ESPN was required. They need the NBA. They need this much of the NBA. They need the tonnage of the NBA. They need to be able to share it with ABC like they do during the finals. So it's, you know, I'm not surprised at all about it. And, you know, we all knew that it was going to be a huge number. I think it's an interesting number for Turner, given the fact that, you know, basically, you had a situation where Turner was announcing the NBA deal at the same time that they were announcing layoffs at different parts of the company. So that's kind of a judo move to pull the PR off on that. But, look, you know, the NBA is, I think there are a lot of people that have taken a deep breath at ESPN now because they love it so much. And, you know, it's been part of their world for so long.
Does this deal and how much they're paying the NBA, does it firmly cement the NBA status as the number two sport at ESPN behind the NFL?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm not even sure. I mean, you know, they've spent some money on tennis lately, and they're giving up NASCAR. They don't have hockey. I mean, I can't even think about what would be number two if the NBA wasn't. And certainly just in terms of dollars involved. But, you know, the interesting thing to look at with this NBA deal, and you got to really think about it, but it's going to be interesting to see how ESPN creates new business models coming from this, because it seemed to me to be a very involved arrangement with the NBA. And so we'll see, you know, what they do with it.
ESPN PR, one of the personnel there, tweeted out how ESPN has all of these major rights deals locked up well past the time that you and I will be alive, Jim, seemingly into the next century. These deals are so long now, and ESPN has pretty much everything locked up, save for the Big Ten, which will come on the scene here in the next couple years. How important is that for them to have these contracts locked up well into the next decade? And now we've talked a bit about the competition with Fox and NBC. I think maybe Fox Sports 1 hasn't been the threat in the short term that maybe the people in LA or some observers thought they would be. How secure now is ESPN's place with their monopoly at the top of the sports world, given these rights contracts and the length therein?
Well, you know, look, the long-term deal is something that's relatively new. And you got to give Skipper some credit here because I think he was a big fan of it. And you got to give Iger credit because he was willing to lay out the money for these longer-term deals. You know, there's a term that people in Bristol and Burbank use about ESPN, which is the moat. You know, how big is the moat? And I think that when you start to see the fact that they have these long-term deals with so many important partners, the moat just gets a little bit bigger. You know, if you're going to, and that is one of the reasons why I always found the Fox threat a little dubious, in terms of them actually being able to go toe-to-toe with ESPN, because where's the inventory? Where's the product? You're never going to do it with original programming and coming up with, I mean, you might come up with a show or two shows or whatever, but that's not going to get you to the promised land. And that's not going to make, you know, that's not going to get you generating over $10 billion in revenue a year, which is what ESPN's doing. So it's just, it becomes infinitely harder for there to be a serious threat to ESPN's supremacy, because there's just less inventory available.
And that's why I think the NBA deal is so important, and Fox not being able to get even a slice of it, because now, you know, they're locked out of the NBA, can't get the NFL. MLB postseason has been doing well for that network, but really, if that's the max that you can do, you know, maybe 3, 4, 5 million viewers, that's going to be a long, long way from what you need to do to challenge ESPN. And that's why I think we've seen expectations dialed back now at Fox Sports 1, as folks realize it's going to take a generation or maybe more for them or NBC or any competitor to really go toe-to-toe with ESPN. What do you make?
Why does it, you know, I think that somebody needs to ask a question, not to sound like an NBA here, but why do you need to go toe-to-toe with ESPN to be successful? I find the whole premise of that to be fundamentally flawed. I mean, look, this is a company with, you know, I put in the book that ESPN was worth more than the NFL, NBA, and Major League Baseball, and the NHL put together. I mean, they have, it's a huge valuation. They had a huge head start. Their dual revenue stream alone was constructed in the, you know, early 80s. So they've had, you know, two revenue streams driving this thing for a long time, not to mention other things that they've done. So why does anyone feel the need to try and take them on like that? In fact, I think that when you, history is showing that when you have a big monster like that and a big behemoth, you know, they're zigging, so you zag. And, you know, and I think that that's probably this smarter move. And I think that's probably, you know, a lot of what needs to happen now over the next couple of years in terms of Fox's thinking.
It's an interesting point you raise, because I think we see that zagging strategy from NBC, because they've gone out and they've got Formula One, English Premier League, the NHL, and they've owned these niche sports. And I think that's why a lot of the what's written about NBC, a lot of the expectations there, would regard NBC Sports Network as a success with what they've done, with the sports they have, how they own those properties. But if you look at Fox and the programming choices that made, the noise that they made, and I think, Jim, it boils down to that typical Fox panache that says, you know, we launched a broadcast network that beat CBS, NBC, and ABC. We launched the cable channel that beat CNN. Why can't we launch the sports network that takes down ESPN in the same way? So I think a lot of it just comes from that mindset at Fox. But we see those two strategies playing out now, with Fox Sports 1 maybe seen as a disappointment because of those expectations. NBC, lower expectations, niche sports, own them. And they, I think, have been regarded as maybe the more successful of the two networks at this point, at least as far as those expectations go.
Yeah, I think it comes down to, at the end of the day, if you're waking up in the morning and you're thinking of ESPN as your competitor, in terms of literally taking them on and trying to get that number one position that they hold, you're smoking crack.
All right, you mentioned John Skipper's contract coming up. We're well into year three of his tenure at ESPN president. What is the biggest takeaway from his reign thus far? How has he distinguished himself from his predecessors in your mind?
I think I'll give you three quick headlines on it. One is, I think he, because he comes from the content side, I think he's much more engaged in content creation, content formulation, than, let's say, George Bodenheimer was. George was a you know, really great guy from the business side. He had obviously done all that great affiliate work and everything else, but one of the reasons why somebody like Mark Shapiro was able to have as much power as he did under Bodenheimer was because George, you know, left the programming and production to Shapiro and, you know, wasn't as involved. So Skipper loves that world, though. So I think that that was kind of a sea change for the company. The second thing is, you know, I think that Skipper probably, to a degree, like we were talking about before. The culture of ESPN has changed a little bit. He's letting people back in the door, and I think that, you know, people have a stronger sense of him. George Bodenheimer had grown up in the mailroom and gone on to various jobs up the ladder, but I think that, you know, he was kind of a private man and didn't want to put himself out there. Skipper loves being the showman. He's hail fellow well met, and he's you know, very accessible, and people I think probably have gotten to know him, you know, in a different kind of way. And then the third thing is that he has he really has engineered a connection with Burbank that he's been able to really prevail when he needed the money. Bodenheimer did that, and Steve Bornstein did that, but they didn't have to do it as often as Skipper has had to do it. Remember, Burbank needs Bristol and ESPN to deliver growth. They can't just rely on their subscriber growth. They have to come up with real growth, and it was much easier to do on Bodenheimer's watch than it is on Skipper's watch. And so Skipper has had to work harder to meet that number, I think it's fair to say, than Bodenheimer did. And, you know, he's coming up with different ways. I think that we're going to start to see significant changes in the business, probably from all the sports networks over the next couple of years. We're going to go through, I think, a very interesting transition now in terms of different models and access to product over the next couple of years. So I think Skipper's had to work a bit harder.
Very quickly, because I know our time is up, the re-release of your Saturday Night Live oral history, Live from New York, just came out. 100 new pages on the last decade. What are some of the best tidbits there that readers will find in the new edition?
I know it was a couple hundred new pages. I mean, look, the reason why I went back and did it was because the last 12 years of Saturday Night Live have been really busy. You know, I got to interview Andy Samberg and Yorma Taccone and Akiva Schaffer and the Digital Shorts, and interviewed Governor Palin and John McCain about the presidential election years. And you had, you know, a big, big, through Tina Fey and Amy Poehler, I think a big resurgence of female power at SNL over the past dozen years. So it was really, it was a lot of fun to do. There was so much to report on, and great people like, you know, Hader and Kristen Wiig and everybody. I mean, even I went back and interviewed Will Ferrell again because he had come back to host. So that was a blast. It was really fun to get back to SNL.
That's on sale now, so definitely check that out. I can't imagine there's anyone listening that hasn't read Those Guys Have All the Fun. If not, do it immediately. Fascinating tale of ESPN. Hopefully there'll be a re-release down the road there and some new stories about Bill Simmons and John Skipper and everything that's happened in the last few years at ESPN. All right, thanks to Jim Miller for joining us. You can now find him on Twitter, at Jim Miller, so very easy to find there. Jim, a pleasure as always, and hopefully we'll get to do this again soon. I know we could spend 3 hours talking about ESPN and everything happening in the sports business world, but glad to have this time as always.
Oh, thanks for having me.